AM and FM, and TV for the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. Scott, how did you happen to pick this interesting topic? Why do you think the world is upside down?
Well, I don't think anybody has to work too hard to think of ways that they see things going on in our world that just seem so completely inverted from what they know in their heart of hearts things should be. I mean, some of them are just the most obvious examples. I mean, when you factor in that we live in a time when a group of people consciously decided that it was somehow God's will or would somehow glorify God to take an airplane and crash it into a building, killing thousands and terrifying millions, then you know just really how much of our world is in need of being put right side up again. And
other people apparently thought it was the will of God to, say, attack Iraq.
Yeah, right. Right. This point of that you get up and it's almost you can't go through a day without being confronted with something that just makes you think in one way or another, you know, the whole world has gone upside down. I mean, it's, from nightly news broadcast where you sort of conclude that the only things going on the planet are a series of horrific events or that the very happiest people in all the world are the people who live in commercials. I mean, you get this just distorted, upside-down sense of so much of things that it just strikes me that it's time to sort of take a step back and ask ourselves if there isn't maybe a more right-side-up way of approaching life and looking at the world. This whole upside-downness really has its source, I believe, in a kind of living that is distant from a sense of God. And the whole material sense of life, it just gets so assumed that that's the norm that we lose sight of something that gives us more of a sense of an anchoredness. I mean, I saw a cartoon some time ago that to me typified some of what I'm trying to get at here. It showed a group of scientists in a laboratory all huddled around their microscopes wearing their white lab coats, and the sign on the door says, Genetics Lab. And this cartoon showed one scientist bursting through the door shouting, Eureka, I've just discovered the gene that makes us believe everything is determined by genes. And it struck me as funny because it sort of exposes the inherent limitations of a strictly material outlook on life, and to me speaks to the need to really find more of a rooted, anchored sense of living in a more spiritual approach to life.
Well, this program, as you know, deals with issues of spirituality and religion and ethics and values and things like that. How did you come to understand your perspective on God? And we'll ask you to talk more about it, of course, in a few minutes. But and listeners, of course, can ask questions and make comments from their own perspectives. But since this is a live call-in program, but where did your idea of God come from?
Well, for me, it came from, in many respects, I suppose, some of my own religious upbringing. I grew up in a very religious home where our faith was a very natural part of our life, and it always interested me. I had a great interest in the Bible. As a Christian Scientist growing up, I just found that what I was learning about God was a very practical sense of God. I mean, it was something that I could I could look for God in relationships I was pursuing, and in terms of feeling guided by God in that, if even schoolwork and trying to really express more of God's intelligence in that, and physical needs when there was need for healing, I found that to be a very practical help. I mean, it's just something that where I felt like the more I read the Bible, the more I tried to follow Christ Jesus' example, the more tangible and concrete this sense of God's presence felt to me.
Now, were both your parents Christian Science practitioners?
No. My dad was a university professor, taught German. He later did become a Christian Science practitioner, but that was after I'd gone off to college, and my mom was a housewife and worked a lot for the United Way and things like that.
And you say your father taught German at a university. Where was that?
That was at Colorado State University.
And did you grow up there?
Yes, I grew up in Fort Collins, Colorado.
Uh-huh. And where did you go to college?
I went to college at the University of Colorado in Boulder and then did my graduate studies at Boston University.
And what did you study at Boston?
That's where I earned a Master of Divinity in Biblical Studies because I was training to be an Air Force chaplain. And after earning a Master of Divinity, I went on active duty in the Air Force as a chaplain for a number of years. And it was after that and then some time working as an editor for my church's religious periodicals that I really decided that my greatest love and interest was in working in the practice, the public healing ministry of Christian Science. And that's when I decided it was time for me to give my full time to working on that.
There are some people, as you know, who when they hear someone is a Christian Scientist, immediately think of someone who never consults doctors or uses traditional Western medicine. How would you describe what a Christian Scientist does in relation to those kind of issues?
There is a strong emphasis on healing in Christian Science, but it is unquestionable that much of the public gets it wrong when they tend to think of that being the sort of the sole issue. It does make it stand out more, but the fact is, it is a church that is really devoted to following the example of Christ Jesus and really doesn't try to put any more emphasis on healing than he did. But clearly, in his life, healing was a very natural part of what he was doing. But the real thing he was doing was opening people's eyes to the allness of God and the ever-presence of the kingdom of heaven. He was just always talking about it. And one of the things to flow out of that was healing, as it touched people's lives. And that's why in Christian Science, we often make the point that healing of physical things is the really smallest part of Christian Science, that the real healing that Christian Science is engaged in is the healing of sin, is in overcoming our sense of feeling separate from God. And as to how an individual practices that, there is no sort of compulsory church thing. It's really the individual relies on Christian Science for healing, not out of compulsion, but out of conviction. It's something that, while to someone who hasn't grown up in it or experienced it, it can sound like just kind of a blind faith thing, but to somebody who has experienced healing reliably in their lives, it's what they turn to because they found it effective. They have found it to be the most reliable means of care, but it is always up to an individual to decide what care they're going to feel is the most effective for them. And if they decide at some point that going to a doctor is going to be the most effective, then that's what they're free to do. But as I say, for example, in my family, we've been relying on Christian Science for healing now for 5 generations. And, in the course of that time, we've seen some pretty remarkable healings. And so it's something that feels like a very natural thing to do. And it's, I think one of the things that gets misunderstood is there's a tendency for somebody not familiar with this kind of healing to think it's kind of a blind faith thing, sort of, okay, God, please heal me, and then whatever happens. And that is not consistent with Christian Science and what it teaches about healing. Christian Science insists that healing comes as a result of understanding the actuality and goodness of God, and that when we understand more of the laws of God that were so evident in the life and teachings of Christ Jesus, we see that there is this underlying power, this underlying goodness that is not a wavering good. It is an always in operation, always reliable sense of goodness and power. I mean, you just don't find an example in the Bible of Jesus coming upon something that needed healing and him approaching it with a sense of, well, I just don't know if there's enough good here, or I just don't know if, you know, God's really present here. I mean, there's this absolute clarity in what he's doing, that God is present, real, powerful, and good, and fully able to bring to light that goodness in the experience of people who are seeking him. And so, as a Christian Scientist prays for healing, he is, or she is, really endeavoring to mentally hold to the fact that God's goodness is present and has power over whatever is, you know, appearing to need healing in the individual's life, and continues to pray and insist upon those laws of God being present and in effect until one sees healing in their experience.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon live with Scott Preller by phone, who is in the public healing ministry of the Christian Science Church. Listeners who would like to make a comment or ask a question or perhaps share one of their own experiences with healing or faith or both, do give us a call. This program is live every Sunday from 5 to 6, and in Champaign-Urbana, where the program is broadcast, you may access several local lines by punching in 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, the call letters of the station. Elsewhere, anywhere in the continental U.S., if you're listening to the station, for example, even online, with our podcast, you may call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. And, of course, if it's a long-distance call, for anybody listening, do use that 800 toll-free number. 1-800-222-WILL. And you'll be live on the air with our guest, Scott Preller. Scott, your last name is spelled P-R-E-L-L-E-R?
Yes, it is.
And we're talking to you from where?
Just north of Boston.
Okay. And you travel around the country, I know.
I do. I'm a member of the Christian Science Board of Lectureship, and I do travel around and speak about Christian Science.
You said you were the scion of five generations of Christian Science practitioners. Let me ask some questions I suspect people would want to ask you.
Mm-hmm.
Were you vaccinated as a child?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't.
Was that not required in order to attend public school, or perhaps you didn't attend public school?
No, I did attend public schools, and there, in many states, there are provisions within the laws that allow for exemption from vaccinations for individuals who oppose it on religious grounds.
Mm-hmm. And do you have children?
I do.
And what decision have you made about that for your kids?
We have the same provisions in the laws here, and they've been very active in sports and activities in school, and have not been required to have those kinds of immunization.
And tell me a little bit about the Christian Science thought about that, when it's so easy to be protected from, you know, mumps and measles and things like that, which if a little child is exposed and gets them, polio, of course, would be another example. Since it's so easy and cheap to do that, and the science shows that it's very effective, why wouldn't you do it?
Well, the issue I think you would really want to ask is, okay, does the record of Christian Science care indicate that the population, if you will, of Christian Scientists have been much more prone to be coming down with these things? And it doesn't. I mean, in other words, the reason I haven't sought immunization is because, not because that I don't want to be protected from these, you know, ills. It's that I really have found Christian Science to be an incredibly effective means of caring for me and, you know, preventing illness.
Now, since you're the son of a college professor and yourself a college graduate and with a master's from Boston U, you obviously know what a valid scientific study would entail. Have there been blind studies by non-Christian scientists that have shown what you just described?
Not in that, in what you call a rigorous medical study. What there are is, you know, just the kind of general studies that, for example, insurance companies do to decide whether this is a group of people that they feel comfortable covering and so forth. And almost every insurance company has looked at, you know, their sense of the record of it and found, you know, that they were very happy to cover Christian Science.
What I've observed, just as an outsider, but I guess the first Christian Scientist that I knew personally was the chancellor of North Carolina State University when I was there in the 70s. And from talking to him, it struck me that Christian Science appeals to people who are educated, who are middle class or above socioeconomically. They'd be pretty good insurance risks. And I wonder if compared to others like that, how things would come out in a strict scientific study.
Well, I would not tend to agree with your presumption of that this is the kind of people that, you know, that Christian Science can be characterized that way. I mean, I think, for example, of the early days of the Christian Science Church, most of the converts, if you will, came out of shoe factories, mills, and things like that.
Oh, sure. I was just speaking of Christian Scientists today.
Well, for my own feeling is that it's a lot more diverse than you're perhaps indicating.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
How many Christian Scientists are there in the world?
I haven't a clue.
In the U.S., do you know?
I really don't know. They don't. Okay. One of the things early on is Mary Baker Eddy, the woman who founded Christian Science. There was such a fixation on how fast it was growing that she actually made a rule that they stopped counting.
Oh, really?
Because people were so it almost became a fad. The church was opening once a week, and it was just spreading like wildfire in its initial days. And so she made a rule that they stopped counting the members. And you know, it's certainly not large by any stretch. It's compared to any mainline churches, it's a very small Christian denomination.
And yet most all metropolitan areas in this country and most university towns would have a Christian Science Church, Christian Science reading rooms.
Yeah, that's true.
Uh-huh. What's the relationship of current Christian scientists to rules made by Mary Baker Eddy?
Well, she put together they kind of grew in a very organic way out of the church that she founded, a series of rules that she put into a church manual that contains a series of bylaws that sort of provide the overall framework within which Christian Science and the organization of the church is still maintained today.
Can that manual be changed?
No, it can't. It's been established by her, and it's what you know. I don't think you would find a Christian Scientist who felt they'd want to change it. It's a very modest thing. It's like if you looked at it, you would find you know. Sometimes we think of governing laws and things as a lot of laws. This is a very modest little book. I mean, it's.
When did she write it?
Well, it grew up over a period of time. I mean, as she formed her church, she would be writing different bylaws as the need arose. And a lot of the bylaws are just about how an individual should, you know, take care, you know, act themselves in terms of how they should treat one another, how they should keeping their own lives and thoughts clear and pure, and so forth. But this, you know, this whole book is, less than 140 pages.
Okay. Scott, I need to interrupt you because we do have a caller waiting on one of our local lines. I'm going to go to line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Scott Preller.
Hi. I was wondering, what is the relationship between the Church of Christian Science and the Christian Science Monitor?
Yes, the Christian Science Monitor was established by Mary Baker Eddy. It's really one of the last major things she did. There was so much yellow journalism in her time, a great deal of muckraking, paparazzi-type style writing going on, that she felt the world really needed a style of journalism that really sought to just tell the truth, to just be very forthright and honest in depicting world events. And so the Christian Science Monitor was established by her and is still today run in a way that's trying to sort of embody her ideals,
mm-hmm.
what journalism should be.
But is it still connected with the Church of Christian Science, or is it...
Yes.
Oh, okay. I didn't know whether it had somehow... lost its connection, but still.
Oh no! It's always been maintained by the church. It is probably, you know, because Christian Science is, as I say, a rather small number-wise church. I think most Christian Scientists consider the Christian Science Monitor one of the main ways of really reaching out and showing the care and concern for the world and what's going on in the world that the Christian Scientists have, and so they. They really seek to try to see that the monitor maintains a kind of fair, even-handed coverage that really gives readers an accurate sense of what's going on in the world.
Right. It's a very respected newspaper. And are the people, the journalists there, are they necessarily Christian Scientists, or do they hire people based on just qualifications and not religious affiliation?
Yeah, that's right. It's a mix. There are definitely individuals who are Christian Scientists working and writing for the paper, but there are also a number who they bring the qualities and a sense of reporting that really is compatible with the monitor. And that's, you know, you may have heard, for example, of the recent, there was a lot of attention when Jill Carroll, who was a freelance writer for the monitor, now she was not a Christian Scientist,
mm-hmm.
But she certainly was the sort of person that brought the kind of attention to detail and wanting to get the story right that the monitor really tries to represent and exemplify.
And are they set up like a normal newspaper? Are they some kind of corporation, or are they like an outlet of the church? Or I'm just curious.
Well, all the financial aspects of it are overseen by the church. It is governed ultimately by the church in terms of its structure and so forth.
So the publisher must always be a Christian Scientist, probably, but not necessarily the editor.
The I don't even know how to explain this. There are many people working for the monitor who wouldn't be Christian Scientists, but as far as I know, the editor has always been a Christian Scientist.
I see.
I can't think of an example where the editor wasn't.
Okay, so the publisher and the editor. Thanks.
All right, well, thank you very much. It's a good paper.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Appreciate the call. Let me remind listeners that this is a live call-in show, Keeping the Faith on AM 580 WILL. A listener-supported service of the Department of Communications at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this program. And let me remind listeners to Keeping the Faith that this program, along with all the others that you enjoy on AM 580, does depend on contributions from listeners. If you'd like to make a contribution, we have a special number for you to call to do that, 217-244-9455. That's 217-BIGWILL, 244-9455. You may call and make a pledge. You may call and add your contribution so that programs like this that cover a wide range of topics, including once a week this program on spirituality and religion, and where we always have articulate people talking about life today from their own perspectives on the air. If you'd rather make a contribution online, that's easy to do. Just go to willpledge.org. That's all run together, willpledge.org. That's our web address, and we accept Visa, MasterCard, Discover, American Express. This is the time of year when, as we approach the end of the fiscal year here at the University of Illinois and the state of Illinois, we're trying to figure out how much money there will be to spend on programs for next year. That's based on how much is pledged and contributed in the budget coming up. So it matters a great deal that if you want to have programs like this continue that are local, that are tied into the community, we do need your support. I'm not the best salesman. As you can tell, I'm stumbling for words, but believe me, my wife and I contribute every year, and we're delighted to do so to keep public radio available. So if you'd like to pledge, do call 244-9455 or online willpledge.org. We have several callers waiting for our guest, Scott Preller. Let's go to line number one. Yes, you're on the air.
Hi, Steve. This is Robin Arbiter.
Sure.
How are you? I have a question. I'm Jewish myself. My adopted family, my mother's side, were also Jewish, but they had a three generation, I guess, habit of affiliating with the Christian Science rather than any formal aspect of Judaism.
Hmm.
And so I did go to Christian Science Sunday School and participated in youth group. And then when I got to college, I have a sister my same age, and we did all these things together. And then when we got to college, we went to Wednesday night meetings. I still think my experience and exposure are limited because I didn't really follow through as an adult, but chose to pursue my Jewish heritage. My question is, and something I struggled with while I was a teen, because I did take medication for epilepsy, and the only time my mother would not let me not take it was when we were on Christian Science activities. I guess feeling that the surroundings would somehow make it okay. And it was certainly not a reflection of my personal power of prayer, because I don't perceive that I had that at that time. And so one of the questions I do have is, when I try to wrap my mind around just to understand what healing means, I come across two things, and I wanted your comment on it. One, does healing mean the same? Is healing synonymous with the appearance of physical wellness in what you might call the non-capital life? And then the other question is, can you accept, could a person consider themselves spiritually correct or spiritually kind of on the right path with Christian Science if you acknowledge that there was not, if you acknowledge that the illusion that you live within in the here and now it does not match like the capital L, and so therefore a complete restoration is not necessarily even possible in the world that we look at through what might be called unsacred or profane or, you know, non-synonyms, without the lens of God and the seven principles.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Robin, for the question. I'm going to let Scott respond, and if you don't mind listening off the air, we do have a couple other callers waiting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Robin. Well, I'll try to speak to some of what you asked. One of the things I just think is just key to understanding what a Christian Scientist thinks about prayer and healing is that it really, at its core, is about experiencing a sense of oneness with God. And to experience that is to come into more of a realization that life really is spiritual, that that's what's really right side up, and that the more we get close to God, we feel and we experience more of a sense of what it means to be spiritual, and that one of the things that comes out of that is that the spiritual reality of who we are as children of God comes to have more supremacy, more actuality, more concreteness in our experience. And we often experience that in terms of healing. And when what we tend to think of as a material problem, something in need of healing, that what Christian Science would insist is that that actually has far more of a mental component than we tend to generally realize. And that when the turning of thought more to allow God as the sole source of our consciousness and our life begins to displace this sense of a broken material sense of existence, that changes what we thought of as this concrete material thing. And so to speak to what your question was about, is it possible to sort of maintain the sense of, well, I guess I just have to put up with things not being right? No, I wouldn't say that. I would say that a Christian Scientist would continue to pray and seek healing until they really experienced a sense of complete freedom and healing, not because they were trying to fix up matter and make matter better, but because they realized that the material picture of discord and suffering was such an affront, if you will, to having the sense of God's allness and God's oneness, that they just wouldn't stop until they really felt that they'd seen tangible evidence that what they were learning about God was more tangible and concrete than the material picture of discord and illness.
We have a couple callers waiting. I want to get to them quickly, but I can't resist asking one probing question about the last call. Robin said that when she was a young girl, she was on medication for epilepsy, except when she went to Christian Science events and so forth. If she'd had a seizure, and I don't know if she did or not, while she was at one of those Christian Science events, what would you say to the young person that happened to?
Well, I guess I'm not quite following your question, Steve, because if you're thinking,
I guess I'm saying, what do you do when there's a failure? What do you do when in spite of people's prayers and good intentions and faith, it doesn't work?
Well, I don't think Christian Scientists would claim, any kind of infallibility. I
sure.
think they feel that their system of healing is very good, but not perfect. I think they feel that the method of healing, they feel they'd be the first to admit they have tons to learn about that, but that the method itself is sound and reliable because it's based on a sense of the goodness of God, the reliable operation of God's power and goodness in our lives, and that, yes, we may have a lot to learn about that. But I do think, it's interesting, that the tendency over the years in the media and by anybody who really hasn't experienced spiritual healing or are not familiar with it, is to always, I've just almost never seen an exception, is to always wonder about the failures rather than ask about or pursue, what success is. I mean, the fact, if there has ever been any spiritual healing, if it's ever genuinely happened to somebody, then to me it says, well, wait a minute, there is something worth looking into.
Mm-hmm.
there is something that says, okay, it is possible to live more from the basis of what Christ Jesus was teaching about the presence of the kingdom of God, and to really feel that in one's life, and to find more of a sense of the power of Spirit to bring healing into your life.
Let's go to caller on line number 2. You're on the air.
Is that me?
Yes. Yes, go right ahead.
I'm very interested in this whole idea. I've been personally and professionally healed, but I'm also scientifically trained. And how do I reconcile those two things? How do I remain right side up in an upside down real world? And I'll listen to your answer off the air. Thank you.
So someone who's trained as a scientist, and yet she feels she has experienced healing, perhaps in relation to her faith. How does she reconcile the two?
Well, I think that a lot of that depends on how you are going to define science. I love the quote by Richard Feynman, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist. He was asked to give a simple definition of science, and his response was, science is the belief in the ignorance of experts. And I like that as a working definition of science simply because what it's saying is, hey, you know what? Science is about figuring out how things work. It is about exploring. It is about asking questions. It is about experimenting. It is about not just thinking what everybody else thought. And it's about a conviction that there are answers, that things are solvable, that there are reliable laws that we can prove in our lives. And I believe that when we bring those qualities of thought to our exploration of our relationship to God and stop allowing that sense of our relationship to God to stay sort of in shadows where we think, well, this is all supposed to be some big mystery, but rather say, no, God is not something that is supposed to be so unknowable to me. That God wants me to know God and wants me to understand more of God's love and goodness, and I can explore that. I can apply it in a very with the same kind of scientific principles of figuring out how things work and what the basis of life is. It's a deeper science because the particular subject of the science that is Christian science is Christ, and seeing how the presence and power of Christ can be applied in human experience to experience healing and a sense of one's oneness with God.
We have another caller waiting on line 3. Let me give the phone numbers for others who'd like to talk with our guest, Scott Preller, who is in the public healing ministry of Christian Science Organization. In Champaign-Urbana, punch in 333-9455. Elsewhere, the toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. And again, let me remind folks who'd like to pledge to help support this program and others on public radio here in central Illinois and Indiana, 244-9455 or willpledge.org is the web address. Let's go to line number 3. You're on the air. Yes, go ahead.
Hello, Irma.
Yes.
On the air. Hello.
Yes, I can hear you.
Yeah. My question is, Christian Science sounds rather paradoxical in the sense, what is the view regarding evolution or Genesis or Darwinian theory?
Mm-hmm.
What's Christian Science's view regarding that?
Yeah. Christian Science would insist that the real, it's a little bit like, how can I explain this? The real identity of man's being is as the spiritual creation of God, and that the whole material sense of life is a limited and distorted sense, a counterfeit almost, if you will, of what life really is, and that within that limited sense, Mrs. Eddy made the point that Darwin made as much sense as anybody, that, you know, he explained how within material limited sense of life, you know, you saw this kind of survival of the fittest thing taking place in the history of evolution. And she thought that made, as much sense as anybody. But she felt it fell far short of the ultimate understanding that the whole material sense of existence itself was an inadequate representation of what really is real and eternally true. It's a little bit like, you know, if you came up on a beach and you saw two identical looking structures, and one was made out of granite and one's made out of sand, you wouldn't wonder which one would be left after the tide came in and out. And for her, for Mrs. Eddy, this whole sense of material existence has to ultimately give place to the reality of man's spiritual existence as the image and likeness of God.
When you were talking earlier, Scott, you mentioned that you were a chaplain in the Air Force for a number of years. How long did you do that representing Christian Science?
It was a very short term. It was just 4 years.
4 years. But let me ask you, following up on an earlier caller, what were some of the positive things that you were able to see people perhaps who'd been injured, perhaps people who were ill, who were in the Air Force, since they have to be really top physical specimens to fly those planes. Can you give us some examples of how the Christian Science approach, focusing on the goodness of God, the power of God, did help people keep to that high level of fitness?
Sure. I should clarify a little bit here. As a Christian Scientist in the active duty military, I was working as, there really are only certain categories of the chaplaincy within the military. So you're either a Catholic chaplain, a Jewish chaplain, a Protestant chaplain, or now I understand they have a couple of Muslim chaplains. But so I was working as a Protestant chaplain, ministering to people of all faiths and walks of life. Within the military experience, the active focus on physical healing would have been only with those who were actively seeking me out as a Christian Scientist within the chaplaincy.
Sure.
And there was, I remember one really remarkable woman who, she was a basic trainee. I was stationed at Lackland Air Force Base. And, you know, these guys and gals that come through there, they just, you know, they don't have a minute to breathe. That's part of the training of it. And I remember she came to one of the early services, the Christian Science services we were holding there on the base. And she had just found out about it and had started to read. She'd gotten a copy of Mary Baker Eddy's book, Science and Health, with Key to the Scriptures. And I'll never forget, she came in. She'd been there 10 days. And she said, you know, I'm only to about page 350, and I just thought that was pretty remarkable. She found time to study that. But came to our services each Sunday very regularly and really was just kind of on fire with what she was learning about God and what she was studying in science and health and how that was opening up her relationship to God. And then in about the fifth week, she came in on crutches, and she had torn something in her leg. And was getting ready to go before a medical review board to decide whether she was going to either have to start training over, wait for the healing, and so forth. And so that was coming up in 4 days, and we did pray together about it. By the time she went to that medical review board, the leg was completely healed. She was able to return to training and complete her training with the rest of her squad mates. You know, that to me was a wonderful example of the kind of effectiveness and the immediacy of the power of God to bring healing.
What was your undergraduate major at the University of Colorado?
I was a political science major.
Mm-hmm. I was a psychology major, and perhaps it's going back to those days that caused me to ask the question that, of course, you've heard many times, but that is, what about the placebo effect? What about the effect that what some people attribute to faith, what some people attribute to the power of God, may just be the effect that's strictly psychological?
Well, you know, I know there are plenty of people who want to write it off that way, but I think that there are, that the healing record, to me, are things that transcend what you could just put into a placebo kind of experience. For example, we had one really remarkable healing in our family here when my wife was pregnant. And we were working with a midwife in preparation for the birth of the child and in accordance with the state laws of Massachusetts. And at one of the regularly scheduled checkups, this midwife told us that she was hearing what she described as an odd echo as she listened to the heartbeat of the fetus. And she told us she wanted us to go to the hospital and have a more thorough examination done, which we did. And the doctor who examined my wife for quite a while told us that the child could not be born normally because of a serious heart arrhythmia that he discovered during the examination. And then he kind of laid out a best-case, worst-case scenario for us, in which he told us that in the best case, you know, he certainly hoped that things, that there was a possibility that this arrhythmia could heal itself as the pregnancy progressed. He hoped that would happen. But he also told us that if it didn't, we needed to begin to prepare ourselves for the idea of surgery in the womb, because, as he put it, there's no way the child could be born normally the way things then stood. And then he went and said he wanted to go get a specialist at the hospital to see if he agreed we could take that approach. And when he left the room, you know, we were definitely concerned by what he just told us. And in fact, but it's also true that we genuinely felt we'd been getting to know that child long before we'd shown up at the hospital that day. And that meant we'd been doing a lot of praying, a lot of reading of the Bible and science and health. And we did immediately call a Christian Science practitioner that we'd been working with and asked for urgent treatment through prayer. But one of the things we realized we had to get real clear about real quick was just what picture of things was really right side up to us and which one really was upside down. Because on the one hand, there was this whole wall of computer monitors showing this erratic heart blip.
Sure.
And there was a sound of this erratic heartbeat being broadcast throughout the room we were in and what that was telling us. And on the other hand, there was what we'd been really learning and feeling deeply. We'd been gaining this deep, deep conviction that this child had actually been created by God and had rights to the goodness and health God was giving, and that God got to decide how this child turned out. And one of the things we turned to at that time in science and health that was so helpful was a place where Mrs. Eddy's talking about Jesus' prayers. She describes them as humble prayers which were, quote, deep and conscientious protests of truth, of man's likeness to God, and of man's unity with truth and love. And so we decided, you know, that we were just going to get real vehement about protesting that the rights of this child couldn't be thwarted by this sense of, you know, disease that we'd just been sort of confronted with. And we were, you know, praying that way for some time. And then the doctor came back into the room with the specialist, and initially he, too, could still hear this erratic heartbeat. But within just a couple of moments after his arriving, the sound of that heartbeat changed perceptibly, and everybody noticed it. And then they examined my wife for a good long time again, but eventually came back and told us that now everything appeared completely normal, and the birth could go forward. And that's exactly what happened, is the child was born perfectly healthy, normal, and passed every one of the postnatal examinations with flying colors. But to me, that moment of healing, it wasn't anything about a placebo. It was not anything about positive thinking. It was, to me, it was such a tangible, immediate change that it was only accountable by the actuality of Christ.
So in giving that example from your own very personal experience, you and your wife with the hope for a healthy baby and then getting it, that would, of course, affirm what you believe and affirm your mission, your occupation, your profession as a minister of public healing for Christian Science. Can you imagine, though, what would have happened if, thank God it didn't, but if there'd been a stillbirth?
Well, I can imagine a lot of things, but the reality of my life experience is that I have found God to be a very reliable help in times of trouble. I think this is part of what's so upside down about our world, is that we tend to, when we come to issues of faith and our relationship to God, it's too easy to continue to distance ourselves from God, to continue to think about why a sense of God's presence and power in our life isn't possible. What if, and what, you know, I think the more pressing question is, when people are confronted with things that, you know, they're told, well, sorry, there's no hope for you, is that the only time it's worth turning to God?
I guess one reason I'm thinking along these lines, Scott, is I was listening to the All Things Considered, which preceded this program, and one of the reports was on the state of children's health in India. And today, 30 million children are malnourished in the country of India.
Mm-hmm.
Where is the goodness and power of God?
Well, I think the goodness and power of God is most evident there in the sincere efforts of people to bring problems like that to light and to commit themselves to saying, no, this can't stand, that this isn't what life is about. There's got to be a way to show. I mean, the correlation I would make is that there's got to be a way to bring to light the fact that you know, God's goodness and love are so abundant that we just don't have to go along with the idea that we're helpless and can't do anything about this. We can express the very love that we feel in our sense of our relationship with God to be doing things, tangible things, to reach out and bring needed food and care to parts of the world the point is that we either spend our time adding up the darkness of this world, or we spend our time proving what we can and what we see of the reality of God in our life. I mean, this whole theme that I touched on a few points about living right side up in an upside down world, I mean, if we're going to take seriously the idea of following Christ Jesus, you know, if you think about his world, it doesn't get more upside down than that. I mean, here he was, the Son of God. He was born in a manger, a feeding trough for animals. He was born at a time when the governing king was so corrupt he ordered the slaughter of all innocent children under the age of 2 when he heard the mere rumor of a threat to the end of his reign. His ministry took place at a time of Roman military occupation and ended with his being crucified as a criminal because of false accusations brought against him. And you know, it just doesn't get more upside down than that. But the point is that none of that stopped him. Everywhere he went, he had this driving message that the kingdom of heaven was present. And no matter how ugly the situation appeared, he insisted God and God's goodness were right there reigning supreme and were available to bring transformation and healing to the situation. And then he proved what he said. You know, he healed multitudes of all kinds of diseases. Now, I'm the first to admit, you know, we have a long ways to go to be really following in his example to that degree. But the fact that healing has been going on reliably for so many generations, in my family's case, 5, is to me just a very encouraging thing to say, well, okay, here's something worth looking into. Here's something worth exploring to be able to say that this kind of experience is really happening in people's lives, that Christian healing is for today. It's not just something we should be looking back on as part of, you know, ancient history that we marvel at, but that real Christian living and following Jesus in the way he said when he told followers that they needed to go and do likewise, you know, to me, it's the great hope of our time.
Scott, we're down to about the last minute and a half. Many religious faiths have had a very good record of reaching out to help people in need with food and medical help of various sorts. What has Christian Science done as a church?
Well, at different times of need, they've set up funds for people to contribute to. This is one of the areas where I think the Christian Science Monitor has helped to bring to light some of these needs that, frankly, a lot of the media has ignored at different times. Mrs. Eddy, saw and was spent a lot of time reaching out and giving much of what she had to different needs that she saw, including some hospitals that she felt were doing good work to help relieve suffering, and she wanted to support, at the very least, their great intentions. So Christian Scientists certainly encourage, the church encourages people to be, active in following their hearts to bring relief to wherever they can.
We've been talking today with Scott Preller, who is part of the public healing ministry of the Christian Science Church. Scott, if people would like to contact you, do you have a website?
I have an email address, which is just scottpreller@verizon.net.
And that's spelled P-R-E-L-L-E-R, Scott with two T's.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Scott Preller at, say it again?
At verizon.net.
At verizon.net. Thank you so much for being on our program, and I do thank our callers today for their very good questions. We can never adequately cover any of the topics we raise, even though we have a wonderful hour to discuss with people. Let me remind listeners that to keep these hours and the many other hours of public radio coming your way, we do need your support. If you would like to make a pledge to help WILL continue its good programming next year, do call 244-9455. That's in area code 217. If you would rather do it online, do go to willpledge.org, willpledge.org. We do accept Visa, MasterCard, Discover, American Express, and, of course, checks. A basic membership level is $40. We know many people can give more. Please consider making a gift to help keep this station on the air. My wife and I do it every year, and encourage others as well. Coming up on Keeping the Faith next week, we'll have a pre-recorded program with Anna Baltzer, an American Jew in Palestine. That will be next Sunday, May 28, here at 5 o'clock. On June 4th, our guest will be Professor Tom Albrecht, a professor of art and design at the University of Illinois. We'll be talking about art and faith. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this program. Support is provided by the University YMCA. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Lincoln Square Village in Urbana, the same square with a new angle, now with shops, offices, activity, and dining facilities, including the law offices of Weber and Thies and McCandless Photography.
You're listening to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois.